Welcome to Sketchy People. Today we're going to be covering Teddy Kaczynski, the Unabomber. Now, you're probably too young to even know who this guy is, but for a while, for about 16 years, he terrified a nation. He made it so that everybody kept on joking that there was a bomb in their parcels, right? They're like, don't open it, might be the Unabomber. And then there was even a couple of times where people who got hit by the Unabomber made that joke in the fatal moments where before it fucking happened. So yeah, it was some pretty messed up shit. And this was during a time where, you know, before the internet, but just as technology was starting to rise. So here comes this guy who's like, I don't like technology. Well, it's a little bit more complex, but we'll get into that a little bit later. Anyways, he finally gets caught. And I guess in the end, we all forgot about him. But for a while, he just held the world's attention. He was the most expensive manhunt for a serial killer in FBI's history at the time. So there was a lot of interest generated in the guy. You know, there was a $1 million bounty on him. Yeah, that was just only after his second bombing there was a $1 million bounty. Never went up, though. I mean, you got to think about inflation. But to really understand Teddy Kaczynski, I think we have to understand him as a person. So let's talk about his life, and then maybe we can get to understand who the hell he was as a person and what kind of impact he had on society. So let's start with this fact that this kid had a really unusual upbringing. So when he was a baby, he had shingles, or they're not quite sure what he had. This is 1943, so medicine was just really getting started, okay? In a lot of ways, sometimes it made things worse to be born back then and go to a doctor than to just fucking wait it out. So they decided that the only cure for poor baby Teddy was to isolate him alone for the first few months of his life. We're talking probably around the first year. And he had this kind of treatment. It worked, I guess. He didn't have his shingles anymore, but he came back and he was not a regular baby. Everybody would tell you he's very healthy, but otherwise highly unresponsive. From then on, the family said that he would have these weird spells as a kid where he would just shut down. Like, you wouldn't even know where he was. Some kind of autistic kind of shit, right? Just a wall of silence around him until he'd pop out of it and get really angry. Yeah, nobody would really know what the fuck that was about. But he wasn't your normal sort of child either. And in a lot of ways, some of that abnormality was extreme intelligence. So when he was in high school, he was getting really bored because he was wicked smart. I mean, wicked smart. They made him graduate at 15 because he was so fucking bored. So from high school, he applies for Harvard University and he gets in at 16 years old. And while he's there, everybody says that every time he comes back, he goes to class, he just beelines straight to his dormitory that smells like fucking sour milk or whatever, and he never comes out. He's like a weirdo. He does not make friends easily. I mean, even when he was a child, they couldn't even get him to do anything. They tried to get him to join the Boy Scouts, and yeah, that did not work. He was having some of his shutdown episodes then, and the Boy Scout leader's like, I don't recommend you forcing him to do something he doesn't like. Although, really, when you think about his future, he would have loved the Boy Scouts, but that's going to be more on that later. So after a while, he also does an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, and he writes a couple papers there, and they're pretty impressive. And what's even more impressive, though, is eventually his thesis, which is about some obscure math, man, and it impresses the professors because they couldn't figure it out. So that's kind of cool. It gives him a bunch of awards, and it gives him a bit of a sort of shoe-in for a tenured position at the University of Berkeley. So he gets that job. So as far as everyone else is concerned, this guy at 20 years old, 20 fucking years old when he's like now has this sweet job. It was the youngest professor to be hired at Berkeley. So there was a lot to prove. But as time went on, I mean, like, he's in his 20s and he's made no friends. His undergraduates are struggling. He doesn't know how to teach. I mean, he's a young man too. Let's be honest here. Okay. Like, most of the people going in there are probably older than him. So, I mean, it can't be easy. And there's a lot of stress on a guy who's just a child prodigy moving up. And he's not, politically speaking, really aligned with most of the faculties. You got to remember, this is the 1960s, specifically, you know, the end part of the 60s. So by then, the civil rights movement has already mostly happened, and there's a big change that's going on in society. We're seeing the growth of feminism, the growth of even things that we would call political correctness, which he really despised. But he's beginning to see this, but he's not matching politically with the rest of the staff. And that's kind of like academically a death sentence, really. You know, I mean, if you look at most universities, there's a 10 to 1 ratio of conservative professors to liberal professors. So he quits 1969, unexpectedly, but I suppose most of his colleagues were not surprised. Anyways, he runs off to his parents and he just takes off, like, you know, and does all these shitty odd jobs, like just the fucking worst type of labor you could imagine, janitorial work, whatever. He works for his brother for a while, but he has to be fired when he's making some like harassment comments at a female worker that he had gone on one date, and she's like, we don't have anything in common. He didn't like that answer and was making workplace kind of like, he was fired for harassment in like the 1970s. How harassed do you need to be for someone who's the boss's brother to be fucking fired, all right? I'll leave that up to you. I mean, either his brother is not your typical 70s guy, or this was some freaking dark shit. Anyways, so for a long time, he decides that he's going to dedicate himself to learning all about the Force and how to fucking survive there, right? Like, he turns into evil MacGyver, essentially, where he's learning all these tricks about how to recycle stuff. He wants to live in the cabin in the woods, so when he's saved up enough money, and this is in 1978, he moves over to Montana, has a little cabin there that's still not too isolated for him, but he just has to fucking put up with it, because that's what $2,000 is going to get you. So he gets a shack without fucking running water or a toilet in there. So, I mean, up to your imagination to see what the fuck he was doing. But anyways, that's the place he builds, and that's where he moves to. And this is where he begins his campaign as the Unabomber. So now let's talk about the bombings. So the reason why the Unabomber is called the Unabomber is because of the way that his career started. So he actually, his first target was the University of Chicago, and it was their engineering department. He was kind of clever, so what he did was he took a package and he left it in the parking lot with a return address being the University of Chicago. But the guy who it was addressed to didn't recognize the handwriting, so he was immediately suspicious. So he called security, and when security opened it up, it exploded in his fucking face. So here's a piece of advice. If you're security and you don't know about bomb defusing, don't try to fucking defuse the bomb, all right? I mean, these were correct instincts from the fucking get-go. People are not retarded, all right? Suspicious packages or, you know, suspicious packages. But this was the first time, right? He had to learn a few lessons. So there was that fiasco. The second thing was that he put a bomb on an airline. It was American Airlines Flight 444. And the bomb did not go off, but it started smoking like a motherfucker, and so the pilot had to make an emergency landing, and everybody had to be treated for smoke inhalation. So as soon as that happened, it became a federal crime, and the FBI could become involved. Now, they decided to give him an acronym, unknowingly giving him a super cool fucking name that would sort of stick in people's heads forever. So that's the reason he's called the Unabomber. Anyways, he continued his campaign for a good, about 16 years. You can see at the beginning of his career, there's not a lot of people that actually get injured. So there's two people, there's the graduate student and there's the police officer who get injured. Then finally he gets the flight. Everybody's got smoke inhalation. Then in 1980, he hits Penny Wood, president of United Airlines.
Percy Wood.
President of United Airlines. Percy Wood, President of United Airlines. Then in October 8th, 1981, the bomb gets successfully defused. So no one is actually harmed in that one. That was the only one that was successfully defused. 1982, Janet Smith, severe burns, so she survived. 1982, University of Berkeley. Gee, I wonder why he sent it to that one. I can't pronounce this. Diogenes
Angelikos. Yeah, we'll say Diogenes Angelikos, engineering professor. 1985, John Hauser, graduate student. Lost four of his fingers. Then in 1985, the Boeing company... Oh, wait, no, they successfully defused that bomb, too.
Oh, they had two defused bombs.
Nice. Nice. But you can see, actually, at least whenever he hit airlines, they seem to successfully survive it. So, yeah, this is what happens when you use recycled materials in your equipment. Then there was University of Michigan. There's James McConnell. And he got temporary hearing loss. And then Nicholas Suino, he got burns and shrapnel wounds. Hugh Scruton, computer store owner. So this is one of the deaths here. And the first fatality, really, a computer store owner. So already he's attacking people just with responsible for spreading computers. And this is computers in the 1985, so you can imagine how advanced those things were. Probably a circuit board with a couple lights on it. This is what a computer was back then, all right? Then 1987, Gary Wright. Severe nerve damage to the left arm. So a lot of damage. You know, there's a lot of scarring from people. Then Salt Lake City. Then in California, Charles Epstein. Then David Gelertner? What do you think it's pronounced?
David Gelemter. Gelemter.
That's not an M, that's an R. Gelernter.
Gelernter.
David Gelernter, computer science professor. He's attacking another computer guy in the 1990s this time. 1994, New Jersey. Thomas Moser, death, the second death. So you can see it took a while even for the second death. And then in 1995, a third death. So maybe he was getting a little bit better with Gilbert Brent Murray in the timber industrially lobbyist. This is the one that actually was died when they made a joke about the fact that he must have been a bomb. So the employees were at first suspicious, but unfortunately Gilbert was kind of like a bit naive and trusting and opened the package and was unfortunately dead. It wasn't even addressed to him, unfortunately.
Say this one.
Gilbert Brent Murray, timber industry lobbyist. Third fatality. He was actually one of the things that made him who he was and who he targeted was he had a bit of an obsession with wood, including his devices. Like there was a lot of wood in his bombs, which is probably one of the reasons why it smoked from before. It probably caught fire or something like that. But in any case, this is also why he attacked that timber industry lobbyist. He had a thing against the lumber industry because every slight against nature was a slight against him, I guess. I mean, this was an individual who managed to find ways to find, I don't know, injury or insult in everything that everybody did. As long as you were contributing to the advancement of society, as far as he was concerned, you were an enemy. And that's almost all of us when you really think about it, right? Like, you are an enemy in a Luddite's view. You're probably unknowingly contributing to the technologicalization? Is that even a word? But anyways, you know what I mean? Like, you're making it more sophisticated. We're using more and more technology. Every time you buy a new phone, every time you go on the web, you're supporting these industries that are constantly in a state of growth. As far as a neo-Luddite is concerned, you are the problem. Now, speaking of Luddite, what is a Luddite? I think it's important for us to mention what a Luddite is. So the name actually comes from someone called Ned Ludd, who was a weaver who was apparently involved in smashing some piece of machinery. Anyways, you know how it is. The first person to smash something usually gets something named after them. But it generally represented a movement of laborers that became more and more organized and began to fight parts of the Industrial Revolution and some of its consequences to labor. I mean, it used to be in the day when you were a weaver, the people that make the clothes on your back, there used to be a pretty powerful lobby of workers. You know, they knew how to organize back then. They understood the political power of labor, and they were very much against industrialization and the way that it could degrade their power. Like, it's a way of removing your bargaining chip from the table. And so they were very aware of this and very against it. But as against it as you can be, progress just fucking happens. So unfortunately for them, and probably fortunately for you, they lost. And now you have clothing made by, well, a series of robots until the worst aspects of are finally assembled by a human. For now, until a robot does it. I mean, don't think it don't. It's not going to get to that. I mean, it's going to get to that. But back to the Unabomber. So after all of these bombings, finally in 1995, he sends a series of letters, and some of them to the FBI, saying that he will stop his campaign of bombings so long as they publish his 35,000-word manifesto. Now, there is a lot of talk about, one, who's going to do this. The first one to come forward is like Penthouse, and they say the fact that they will publish it, which Unabomber does not fucking like. He's like, if they publish it, then I'm going to fucking blow more shit up. So he wants basically every major news outlet to publish it because he wants the whole world to read it. So they're kind of stuck in a situation. It's been 16 years. They have not caught this man. They don't think they probably will be able to. As far as they're concerned, they're looking for a man called Nathan. I mean, it turned out that when they were doing a psychological profile of him during the first two bombings, the first guy to actually come up with a profile, his name was John Douglas, all right? He was an FBI guy that came up with this whole concept of FBI profiling. Anyways, he's the inspiration of the guy Jack Crawford in Silence of the Lambs. Yeah, that cool. He made the correct assumption that the guy must have been an intellectual, but because of the crudity of the bombs, which used recycled materials, because this is how much of a fucking environmentalist this weirdo was, he had to reuse parts in his bomb. So they were fucking crude as shit. So everybody thought it must be some kind of airline worker who's, you know, angry or whatever, or disgruntled. You know, it's not this intellectual. But it, goddamn it, it was. So yeah, the dude was right. Trust guys who are superstars that will eventually become, you know, inspiration for cool movie characters that try to bring down psycho killers. Because these people actually exist, apparently. This is a thing. So the manifesto, there's a discussion for a while amongst the FBI and amongst other people about whether or not they should do it. Now, they conclude that they should give in to his demands because in doing so, there's a high likelihood that he'll be able to be identified by someone who will read the manifesto and then recognize, hopefully, the person's writings. So they do it. They capitulate. They give in to the terrorist demand. This is like that scene in Seven where the guy perfectly plans everything so that by the end of it, he just gets shot in the head because, damn it, he knew what he was doing right from the beginning. This is a fucking checkmate on the goddamn government. And the New York Times publishes it. I mean, and this thing explodes. It goes on to be on the bestseller list, by the way, and makes a ton of money. I don't know who's making that money, although eventually it does go to many of the victims. And Kaczynski is working very hard to get those rights back. Probably won't. But anyways, so there's a lot of things that you can say about the writing. The first is that there's a lot of animosity towards the left. You can clearly see what his suspicions and, like, for instance, he felt that the left could not be trusted to do anything useful, that there were constantly people who had low self-esteem, didn't believe in self-actualization or any of those things, and would basically weaken society and make it so that, you know, in their world of complete equality, nobody wants to do anything and there's no individual achievement. This is how he felt. I understand part of what he feels like. Damn it. Sometimes it really does seem that way, but I'm not going to mail bombs at people, God's sakes. So, old Teddy here, his feelings are kind of, not only is the left like the big problem, but he also says that society is sickened by the fact that people have really no purpose. So he says that in life, one of the things that people don't acknowledge is that this need for power. People must have some form of power. Now, of course, not everybody can have ultimate power. He kind of makes weird, you know, I don't know, he seems to condone the actions of aristocracy. I think he really does believe that there's like this upper crust of people in a very lower class, right? Like he's that kind of guy. But he definitely thinks that everybody should have some form of purpose in their life, even if it has to be made up. Otherwise, you're going to feel sick. And he predicted, or he thought, that most social ills were really caused by this this lack of purpose. And he says that the more you have this lack, the more social ills you're going to face. So the worst thing you can have in a human being, as far as Teddy Kaczynski was concerned, is idle hands. Cannot have a fucking person who does not try to, you know, does not have the will to survive. And part of his whole going back to nature philosophy of living off the land is part of that. Like, I'm sure he felt a great deal of satisfaction. His brother David, in fact, was for a long time an admirer of his kind of, you know, of this view, because he felt that his brother had basically accomplished what he had set to do, which was to be self-sufficient out in the wild and not really require much. You know, I mean, most of the time when he went to town, it wasn't to buy many supplies. It was to go to the library and take out books of like super dense material. Like the librarian was like, okay, like, you want to read this book on microeconomics? All right. Like, it seems a little dense, but that's what he liked. He didn't like any of the cheap fucking shit they had in the library otherwise. Do you want to read some Le Carré? No, I do not. Anyways, so they published the manifesto. And like I said, it's 35,000 letters. I mean, 35,000 words. This is a lengthy beast here. This is almost half of a novel, all right? But somehow people read it, and there's a certain kind of, like, the third thing that he talks about that really struck me, at least, for, you know, or perhaps scared me a little, was kind of his future prediction of how you could bring about change within the system. He said, forget about political revolutions, because none of this has to be a political revolution. He stressed the idea that we could make economic and technological changes without necessarily bringing down governments. But what he did say is that in order to be able to do that or facilitate this, you would have to have some kind of crisis. So he said in order to be able to create that crisis and make it a global thing, the best thing to do was to push free trade as much as possible and make the entire world's economy entangled, so that when it did collapse, it would all collapse. And he says at that moment is when you can have, like, true change. So I'm, you know, what's weird and scary is that whether or not he knew it, he's kind of predicting what would basically happen. Although I don't know if it's A, someone who read his manifesto and is like, I know what to do, or just kind of like really good guessing as to how the situation would go. I certainly hope no one read his manifesto, is secretly working to bring this whole system down in that sense, and is like, Teddy Kaczynski is my fucking hero. Like, you know what I mean? I would not want that, because so far his plan is working out perfectly. Right. Now, after the manifesto is published for a while, there is some silence, at least from the part of any real lead, not in the part of people actually phoning in to cash the $1 million. The FBI for months gets 1,000 calls a day of fucking shit leads. Everybody wants that money. And because his manifesto reached out there, I'm sure that there's tons of people who are like, I got some hippie brother-in-law who's got some things to say about leftists. Do you know what I mean? Like, it probably spoke to a lot of people, and they're like, everybody's got to be the Unabomber. I mean, it turned out that even the people who knew some of the writings of Ted Kaczynski disagreed about the fact that it was his writing. There was no real consensus. They said that it didn't really sound like him. So, you know, it seems a little bit weird that even people couldn't recognize his writing, but it had been a very long time anyway. This man had been isolated in a shack for almost 20 years. Yeah, your writing could change. But there was some parts of it that did seem familiar, and they seemed familiar indeed to his brother David, who was encouraged by his wife to look into the family, you know, dustbin of papers and whatever, and there he found some of the early parts that eventually made it into the manifest. So at this point, David was a little crushed, but he decided that he needed to notify the authorities, not for the money, but really just because he didn't want any more deaths. I mean, remember, two dead in a row now. It was starting to get pretty fucking deadly. Now, he didn't want it to be known that he was the one that called. Unfortunately, there was a leak in the FBI, and they fucking told Dan Rather, who said it on the news, that it was him. So, yeah, no anonymity at the FBI, bitches. CBS was gonna out your ass. So, yeah, he found out that it was his brother. I mean, but because of that, when they finally arrested him in his cabin and found not only the typewriter that he had written it from, because, yeah,
He's a Luddite. He's not writing it from anything other than one of them old school typewriters that had, like, you know, distinct keys that they used to match the manifesto. And they found all the bomb-making materials that matched the types of materials that he was using. And that's where they found that he was recycling his materials, which is why it was so baffling. They could never find the hardware stores that he would buy these things at, because he would reuse parts from other things. So you couldn't predict what things he was using in his bomb, because he was fucking MacGyver, all right? He was MacGyver, evil MacGyver, who was against technology. It's just weird, like using technology against technology. I mean, okay, takes all kinds to float the boat. So he gets arrested, and the only way that he fails to get the death penalty is effectively to plead guilty to all of the charges. He gets 8 life sentences, though, and he's been put in prison, but he's not dead. I mean, probably most of you think that he's dead, but he's definitely not dead. And he's so not dead that he has correspondence with over 400 people. Most of these will actually be released in like 2064, if you want to know who they are. So you'll be a fucking dead man by the time you can find out who the hell this man has been talking to. But he has enough rights to petition to have that degree of anonymity. Great. Fantastic. So who are these people? I don't know. Anarchists, maybe? Fans? I almost want to just ask him, what's he up to these days? Like, hey, what do you think about the world, Mr. You know, the environment is being destroyed. How do you feel now with these super hot summer days and these crazy natural disasters happening? Do you feel vindicated? How do you feel? Honestly, the way every article that I've read about him recently says that he loves his prison. And maybe it feels like when he was an infant in that weird isolated little place where he doesn't have to think about anything, and he just can just read all day, study languages and composers, and study the mind, which is what he's always seemed interested in. Never seemed to have much of an interest in fucking human beings or their well-being, their safety. Definitely always thought that he was bigger and superior than everybody else, that he should have been more praised, I guess. I mean, it's difficult to know exactly how a mind like that works. I mean, it's not a normal mind, all right? So there's definitely some things happening in there. But yeah, that's the life of Teddy Kaczynski, the Unabomber, the guy who made you afraid to open your mail for 20 years. You think we can edit that together?